From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the Harmonic Universe. Here's what's happening. Well, if you thought you were safe from Lyme disease because you didn't live in the New England area where the tick-borne illness first appeared, think again. Now all 50 states plus the District of Columbia have residents who have tested positive for Lyme disease. About a wide variety of symptoms, including joint aches, fatigue, facial palsy, and neck stiffness. Jeez. President Donald Trump has renewed sanctions on Iran as he followed through on vows to unravel the Obama deal with Tehran. The move comes 3 months after Mr. Trump pulled out of the deal, and we shall see what happens there. Dictator, North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un wants to create an army of super soldiers who will obey his every command. Genetic scientists have apparently spent billions on a secret cloning program started by Kim's grandfather more than 30 years ago. Now intelligence experts believe that the 35-year-old tyrant also wants to create perfect copies of both his father and his grandfather and himself. Meanwhile, North Korea State Agency has called for the United States to ditch crippling economic sanctions as a reward for North Korea's show of good faith in ending its nuke weapons testing and transferring the remains of American troops killed in the Korean War. Let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. Well, is that a justified, well-warranted request by North Korea, John?
I think so. George, my position on it has been very clear that the U.S. has to make concessions to North Korea, not a demand of unilateral disarmament, but rather a phased process. That's all they're asking for. And what they really want right now is a peace treaty. And once a peace treaty is negotiated, and the Trump administration, you know, Pompeo and some of the generals that are attached to this have basically put the cart before the horse, and that is saying that we want disarmament first, then we can talk about sanctions relief. But I think a little bit of sanctions relief, as you know, you can always snap back sanctions. That's certainly happening in Iran right now. And you could do it in North Korea, too. So what is the problem of the U.S. Ending certain sanctions and providing some kind of good faith effort like a peace treaty in order to get the, you know, Stalinist regime of Kim to eventually disarm their nukes, which is, you know, the Trump's goal and the goal, I think, of everyone.
Well, what's taking so long to do something like that? It sounds obvious and smart.
Well, I think, you know, that's the only bargaining chip that North Korea has. They have nothing else. Their economy is in ruins. They're in mass starvation over there. So the nuclear and missile bargaining chip is all the levers they have. So they're playing with it in a very careful way. And I think the way to approach it for, you know, the State Department is basically to say, okay, we'll phase out some of the sanctions right now in exchange for, in addition to developing a peace treaty, signing a peace treaty, in exchange for the dismantling of those nukes and ballistic missiles. And I think it will be a go.
Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. A sprawling blaze in Northern California grew on Monday into now the second largest wildfire ever recorded in the state, a day after President Donald Trump declared a state of emergency, highlighting the ferociousness of this year's fire season. Already this fire has scorched 273,000-plus acres out there. Dr. Tim Ball with us, climatologist. Boy, Tim, it doesn't get much worse than this, does it?
Well, it's been much worse in the past, and in fact, this is perfectly normal. And, of course, what they're doing is taking it out of context. Governor Brown said this is the hottest it's been in 10,000 years. That's completely false. In fact, for 9,000 of those 10,000 years, it's been warmer than today. And 9,000 years ago, it was 41 degrees Fahrenheit warmer in the world than it is today. The pattern in California is that you've got a unique kind of climate. It's called a Mediterranean climate because the Mediterranean region of Europe, which was first identified by Köppen, the climate classification expert, and it's unique in that it's got winter rainfall and summer hot and dry. Everywhere else in the world, you get summer precipitation. So the pattern is that you get hot and dry in the summer, and as a result of that, you get a plant growth that has to be able to withstand that hot and dry. So you've got the chaparral in California and the maquis, as they have in the Mediterranean region. And then as the fall comes on, it cools down and the rain starts to begin. But before you get the rain, because of the very hot and dry, you get these fires through mm-hmm. these very dried out vegetation. So this is a normal pattern. And then once the rain starts, of course, because the vegetation has been burned off, you end up with the mudslides. And so you'll hear that coming up in California soon. So, and by the way, there is much less fire now as when we take sediment cores off the coast of the Pacific, in the Pacific Ocean, you can see the carbon sediments from these fires, and it is far less now than it was over the historic record. Part of it is that when the Europeans arrived, of course, that you were able to stop the fires. But a lot of the fires were set by the Aboriginal people for hunting purposes. And so what we're seeing is a decrease in the number of fires, not more. And so the whole pattern is perfectly normal. What's going on right now is well within natural variability. But, of course, they're pushing this agenda that the world is frying, and you see the claims about global warming temperatures. Virtually no records have been set, but this is the agenda that – and you can see that Al Gore's out there again pushing it.
Okay, Dr. Tim Ball, thank you so much. A story we've been reporting on, a mysterious radio signal has been spotted by a telescope in Canada, and it's one of the lowest in frequency to date. But astronomers have no idea where these mysterious signals are coming from out there, and they don't know what the origin is. They're baffled. What else is going on in the skies? It's time for Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hi, Stephen.
Hello there, George. And just to continue on what you mentioned before, these fast radio bursts, as you mentioned, discovered back in 2007, this Canadian radio telescope actually detected one at the lowest frequency yet, which is 580 megahertz. Why is this important? Well, nobody, as you mentioned, understands where these signals are coming from. Some think the collapse of black holes, pulsars, and other neutrino stars. Stay tuned for that. But George, we transition quickly to aviation and space. China just recently tested a whole new type of aircraft. It's called a hypersonic aircraft, officially known as Starry Sky 2. It's capable of flying at Mach 6, that's over 4,500 miles per hour, and launch deadly so-called unstoppable nuclear weapons. Sounds like sci-fi, but it uses technology called wave rider technology. Simpler terms are compression lift. This is something interesting. But George, the live sky rules this particular segment here this week. Naturally, the biggest meteor shower of the entire year is going on now and peaks over the weekend. It's simply the Perseids. We talk about it every year, George, but this year really spectacular. Folks, pay attention to this because the moon is at its new phase over the weekend. If you have clear skies, begin to look in the northeastern part of the sky starting around 10 p.m. Why, George? Because this is the time that you may get to see these Earth Grazer fireballs. What are these? These are fireballs that can be as bright as the full moon, albeit they're few and far between. Then the radiant rises in the northeast and upwards with clear and dark skies, maybe 80-plus meteors per hour. The nucleus of this comet 109P Swift Tuttle, George, is actually the largest solar system object that makes regular visitations toward the Earth. And if it were to hit, that is the nucleus, how horrific, it would be 20 times the energy of the particular asteroid that hit 65 million years ago. And finally, folks, and George, we're excited. We're up in Sedona this week.
This is it for you. Perfect.
Oh, and this is going to be good. Mars and Meteor Madness, give them a call over there, Sedona Rouge, but check their website, sedonarouge.com, and give me an email or send me an email at drsky@cox.net to learn more about the event, a great way to celebrate Mars and our meteor event. for those of us here in Arizona. Dr. Sky reminds everyone, as always, always remember to keep your eyes to the skies.
Super. Thank you, Dr. Sky. Great reports. For 60 years, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, has held a singular and enduring mission to make pivotal investments in breakthrough technologies for national security. What else is DARPA doing? In a moment, Sharon Weinberger joins us. Her latest work is called The Imagineers of War, The Untold Story of DARPA, the Pentagon Agency That Changed the World. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We've got a great couple hours here for you and a great couple more hours later on tonight. But Sharon Weinberger with us, executive editor at the Foreign Policy and is currently a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University and a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She has also held fellowships at MIT's Knight Science Journalism Program, the International Reporting Program at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. She has written on military science and technology for Nature, the BBC, Discover, Slate, Wired, and The Washington Post, and others. Her latest book is called The Imagineers of War, and here Sharon is on Coast to Coast. Sharon, looking forward to talk with you, and welcome to the show. First time you've been on, I understand.
Yes, it is. Thanks for having me.
Great. Lots to talk about. DARPA. Who created it?
So DARPA is a creation of the Defense Department. It was created back in 1958 as a direct result of the Soviet Union's launch of Sputnik in the fall of 1957. The idea was that Sputnik was a psychological defeat for the United States. It signaled that the Soviet Union was ahead of the United States in the arms race, in the space race, but it also signaled more fundamentally that the technology needed to launch a rocket into space was linked to the technology that could be used to launch an intercontinental ballistic missile against the United States. It sort of signaled the end of an era post-World War II of U.S. invincibility, the idea that the Soviet Union could send a nuclear weapon to the United States. So President Eisenhower authorized the creation of what became the nation's first space agency. Before NASA, there was DARPA, or ARPA as it was called at the time, that was going to consolidate all of the rocket programs and all of the space programs into one agency under the Defense Department.
I was 7 years old when Sputnik first went up, Sharon, and I remember my parents and how nervous they appeared when Sputnik was up there. I mean, here was this little basketball-sized satellite that didn't do much. But you're right, the Russians, the Soviets at the time, they got one up there before we did. Did our intelligence even know that they were about to launch that?
Yes and no. So there's both the reality of Sputnik and then some of the myths behind it. So, of course, I mean, the very fact that you remember it, that people from that era, even children, remember that idea, their parents being scared that there was this beeping satellite overhead. You know, but the reality at the time was that President Eisenhower sort of downplayed it initially, which did not come off well politically at all. He was sort of accused of being weak, especially by Lyndon Johnson. But the idea was he knew about classified programs, secret programs that the public didn't know about. He knew the United States had the U-2, this high-flying aircraft that could fly into Soviet territory. He also knew that the CIA and the intelligence community were working on the first reconnaissance Earth imaging satellites that would be able to take pictures from outer space, but he couldn't talk about that publicly. It was well known that the Soviet Union was developing rockets. It was well known they were developing ICBMs, as was the United States. The Soviet Union was a little bit ahead, basically on thruster technology. You know, they were months ahead. But it came, you know, so on one hand, it wasn't a shock for the intelligence community. Yes, they got there first. On the other hand, what was a shock was how this was going to play publicly, that it was really going to come off as a symbolic defeat for the United States and a huge symbolic psychological win for the Soviet Union.
When we formed DARPA then, were we scrambling or was it a very logical progression when they put the agency together?
Oh, it was very much scrambling. Because, you know, on one hand, Eisenhower knew some of these things the public didn't know. On the other hand, he was dealing with this sort of, you know, panic and political fallout from the event that could kind of be compared to sort of what happened after 9/11 in the United States. And what was true was the United States had not organized their space programs well. The Army, the Navy, and the Air Force were all sort of competing with their own rocket programs. You had Wernher von Braun and the German rocket scientists who were stuck down in Alabama, who said basically, you know, we have a rocket that can go into space. But the United States had sort of placed its first bets with a Navy program called Vanguard that wasn't going very well. So, things were a mess. And so, you know, very quickly in Washington, you know, when you want to fix a problem in Washington, what do? You create a new agency. And so very quickly they put forward this proposal that first was going to be just sort of called the Special Projects Agency, and they were worried that we'd confused with special operations. So they came up with this very sort of bland name, the Advanced Research Projects Agency. And what was so interesting is it was really thought of as a temporary measure. This wasn't something they thought was going to be around for 60 years. It was kind of a quick fix, throw some Band-Aids on it. And in fact, the directive creating what became known as DARPA basically said this agency is going to, you know, do such projects as directed by the Secretary of Defense. Like, you know, that was its whole remit, with the idea that space was going to be the first part of it. But it was very quick, haphazard. You know, when DARPA opened its doors in early 1958, there was essentially one employee, a director.
And when the Soviets got Sputnik up there, they too had German brain power after the war too. We got our parts, they got theirs. Were there German scientists the ones that got Sputnik up there?
Well, you know, what's interesting about that period, so as you talk about, with Germany's defeat in World War II, you know, the next thing was who is going to get these rocket scientists, these German rocket scientists. And the United States really got the cream of the crop, Wernher von Braun and his rocket scientists. The Soviets were kind of left, I don't want to say with what was left, but they took, you know, the Soviets took a lot of equipment. They got less of the people, but they did get some German rocket scientists. So there are these great minutes from the U.S. National Security Council after the launch of Sputnik, where they're talking about, you know, how is this going to play publicly? And they're like, well, we're going to claim the Soviet Union was ahead because they got all the good German rocket scientists, which just wasn't true. The cream of the crop went to the United States. So like with the United States, what the Soviet Union did had, it helped them with their rocket program, but you can't say that the German rocket scientists made the Soviet rocket program. They got some of the people, they got some of the equipment, but it was that in combination with Soviet scientists. And more importantly, democracy work really well for certain things. But the one advantage sort of an authoritarian regime has, the Soviet Union had at the time, is that you don't have to deal with dueling bureaucracies. You know, you can have, an authoritarian regime can just make a decision. You're not going to have the Army, Navy, and Air Force all lobbying for their funds. And so the Soviet Union was able to sort of, with a singular goal, move forward, you know, more quickly than the United States could.
So what is DARPA doing now, Sharon?
Well, in some ways, DARPA is doing what it was doing some 60 years ago, meaning it is doing such projects as directed by the Secretary of Defense. They're still doing space programs. They're still doing new technologies. One of the sort of what I would call a myth that has developed over the years, that we sort of look back retrospectively on what was DARPA's mission. A lot of what came out over the years is, you know, what does DARPA do? Okay, DARPA's supposed to stop Sputnik-like surprises. So DARPA will often say that our goal is to stop technological surprise, which means to stay ahead of the adversary. Well, that's changed a lot in the past 20 years with the fall of the Soviet Union. The United States really doesn't have a close peer adversary. You know, maybe China is getting close in some technologies like hypersonic weapons. Maybe in some areas, Russia is sort of still keeping keeping up, but really the United States is ahead. But what DARPA continues to do is invest in sort of technologies that are far-reaching, in some cases futuristic. But I would say this mythology of what it does has become more and more over the years. I think there's more the impression these days that it's a science fiction agency. And indeed, that was always part of the DNA of the agency, but it was a mix back in the early days, you know, because Sputnik was an immediate thing. So yes, DARPA in its earliest days did very sort of futuristic projects. One of its first projects was an attempt to create a force field around the Earth to stop intercontinental ballistic weapons. That was very futuristic.
Sounds like then. Star Wars and Star Trek, doesn't it?
Exactly.
We're going to come back in a moment, Sharon, and take more questions later on tonight with you, but great discussion. Sharon Weinberger with us, her book, The Imagineers of War. Well, we only want to be with you Saturday, August 25th in Asheville, North Carolina. That's where we're going to be with our live stage show. Really looking forward to it. I'll tell you in a second how you can get your tickets out there. The producer, executive producer, is Tom Danheiser, and he selects the guests.
George, this one is coming up fast, and we're going to have some fun. We're going to start out with ufologist Micah Hanks. We have William Forstchen. He'll talk about his book, One Year After, and, you know, the solar
the
attacks on our planet. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Of course, Joshua P. Warren in his wacky world. You never know what he's going to do.
He's got some surprise.
He does.
We're gonna, I can feel it.
We're going to practice something. We're going to have some fun. And then we're going to have spiritual teacher and psychic medium Vincent Jenna. And he has agreed to do a live read on somebody on stage. This is going to be great. This is going to be a lot of fun. And then, of course, the thing I really look forward to is the meet and greet and saying hi to everybody afterwards.
The meet and greet lasts as long as the show.
We never leave.
And the show's a long show.
It is. It's about 2.5-3 hours.
And don't forget the singing.
Oh, yeah. You're going to sing some songs.
Absolutely.
And there'll be a band.
We're going to have some fun doing that.
We will.
Okay, this is how you get your tickets, and this is what's available seat-wise, folks. On the bottom level, there are 5 handicap seats, and then there are 4 regular seats on the sides, 2 on each side. That's it on the bottom level. Then the rest are in the balcony. It's a great theater. You got great seats no matter where you sit, but you'll have to go up to the balcony after those extra 4, and then the 5 handicap seats are gone. Just go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, click events at the top of the homepage, or click the carousel reel. You'll see the revolving event for Asheville, North Carolina, or you can go to their theater's website, dwtheater.com, dwtheater.com, and type my name in the events section. And welcome back to Coast, Sharon Weinberger with us, her book, The Imagineers of War. Are the projects from DARPA, Sharon, public or secret at this point?
It depends on the project. DARPA has always had classified programs, which sort of fall into 2 categories. One are programs that we know about, but they kind of don't discuss in detail because they're classified. But DARPA has always had a history of black projects. And by black, I mean these are projects that aren't even acknowledged publicly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, over time, I would say about a third of its budget has been classified. It's hard to say how many of these are truly black programs, but we know about some of them because they become public in later years. So, for example, in the 1970s, DARPA worked on the first stealth aircraft. These are aircraft that, you know, are sort of invisible in the sense they can evade radar. These were black programs at the time, not even acknowledged. Certainly, DARPA has black programs today that we may never find out about or may not find out about for 10, 15, 20 years.
When you try to get information to write this book, and other researchers have tried to get information, who do you go to? And is it available to you, or is it like pulling teeth?
So some of it is available, and a lot of it was like pulling teeth. So some of it I was able to get by interviewing people. I interviewed people back from when DARPA first opened its doors in 1958. up through the present day. And sort of the further you get away in history, the more people are willing to talk about secret work. So a lot of the very sort of very classified work that DARPA did was during the Vietnam War period. And I was able to go back and interview some of the officials who were still alive and worked on some of these top secret projects who, you know, were more willing to talk about it now, in part because some of this work was declassified or they presumed it was. Another thing I was able to do is go to the National Archives and Records Administration and request that material be declassified under automatic declassification reviews. So, for instance, DARPA was involved in a very top secret program to help protect the president that was initiated in the days after President Kennedy was assassinated. You know, they wanted DARPA to develop sort of new technologies to protect the president. And then one of the final strategies I employed was to sue the Defense Department for information that I felt should be declassified or have been declassified. So it's a mix of getting people to talk, using the Freedom of Information Act, and when government is still resistant, suing them under the Freedom of Information Act.
Did you come across anything about UFOs or anything like that?
Not so much UFOs specifically. There's certainly a lot of bizarre, strange technology that DARPA has been involved in over the years. You know, everything from they've been involved in mind control projects to parapsychology to ESP. UFOs, there's certainly nothing that I saw specifically in my research that DARPA was involved in. I think there's certainly a lot of other parts of the Defense Department that have been involved in sort of, you know, unknown incidents, sort of aviation incidents, but not DARPA specifically. I think more because they're in sort of the research and development business rather than spotting things.
Let's talk about the internet for a second, Sharon. Was the internet created at DARPA?
So the internet is, DARPA can certainly claim that it is the originator of the internet. It came out of early work in the 1960s, somewhat directly out of the Defense Department's interest in command and control of nuclear weapons. A myth has developed over the years that ARPANET, this is the internet created by DARPA. So there's the myth that ARPANET itself was a nuclear command and control system, which isn't quite accurate. What is accurate is there were a lot of concerns about how do you get computers to talk to each other so you can do things like track incoming Soviet bombers? How do you control nuclear weapons, pass the information? So this is why DARPA got involved in the business in the early 1960s. But the guy who they got to start this program, J.C.R. Licklider, often called the godfather of the internet, he was interested in much more than nuclear weapons, but the entire idea of how humans interact with machines, how we interact with computers. And he really foresaw a day where human decision making was going to be integrated with machines, the way we sort of use Google as our extended memory. The original ARPANET, which transitioned later to the internet, is very much DARPA's creation.
Do they have private companies working there too, Sharon, or is it all self-employed people?
So DARPA is a really interesting institution in terms of government. And one of the things that it makes it unique is it has today about 140 personnel, which are not permanent personnel. These are scientific managers called program managers.
And where are they all based?
And so they're based in DARPA's headquarters in Northern Virginia, a few miles from the Pentagon. And these are scientists who come in from industry, from academia, sometimes for the military and serve for 2 to 5 years, but they're all temporary. The idea is the agency is not supposed to have permanent employees.
And but do they farm out projects too to like Boeing or companies like that?
Exactly. So DARPA itself is not a sort of a science laboratory. With very rare exceptions, it doesn't actually do the work in-house. It's contracting the work out, you know, some with Boeings and Lockheeds, but usually traditionally with researchers in universities, with laboratories, with institutes, and with smaller companies as well, but also sort of with the traditional companies.
It's almost like a holding company, and it's got all these little subsidiaries that they tap into.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, the idea is to be able to sort of tap the best and the brightest. And so that's always been the case that they have contracted the work out.
Didn't DARPA also play around with ESP, extrasensory perception, and things like that?
They absolutely did. It's this fascinating history that goes back to the 1970s. And what actually happened was that the CIA was very interested at the time in ESP and parapsychology, and they were funding work at SRI, formerly known as the Stanford Research Institute in California.
Remote viewing and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, and they were working with Uri Geller, sort of the Israeli magician entertainer who also says he has sort of parapsychological powers. And the CIA absolutely loved this stuff, and they thought the project was great. And so they wanted DARPA to come in and help fund it. And so DARPA sent one of its scientists out to California to look at what Uri Geller and these scientists at SRI was doing. And actually, it ended up being a big dispute between DARPA and the CIA. DARPA ended up not funding it. And then the project went public. It got slapped on the cover of Time magazine and caused all these problems for the CIA.
I mean, we've interviewed on this program a number of the government remote viewers who are part of the programs. They're not doing it anymore, but just amazing material coming out of there, Sharon.
Oh, it's an absolutely fascinating history, and it's really this clash of scientific values, of people who were out on the edge of science. So for the people who support the program, you know, the CIA was doing this great work. It was doing out there work. And, you know, George Lawrence, who was the scientific manager for DARPA, who was sent out, ended up being this enemy of the program for years, long after he left DARPA. You know, it's a clash of people who thought this was worth pursuing, it was doing good work, and people who thought it was a big waste of money. What's interesting about DARPA's involvement in the program was, although they decided not to fund the SRI work and not get involved in Uri Geller's work, what they did get involved in that was equally interesting was mind control, not through ESP or parapsychology, but the idea of using computers to tap signals in the brain so that you could, you know, move things, control things with the human brain. So today this is leading to things like neuroprosthetics. Prosthetics can be controlled directly with the brain, or with even more out there work of brain-computer interface, the idea that maybe someday you could control a drone with the human brain, or robotics, or other types of machinery, or the cursor, or, you know, your computer, that you could use a computer without ever touching a keyboard, just by reading neural signals.
They must, with technology today, Sharon, they must be dabbling in some amazing things.
Oh, yeah. I think the area that they're involved in, you know, when we look at DARPA in 20 years from now, you know, just like we look back at what they did with computers and the internet in the 1960s and after, I think one of the most exciting areas that DARPA is involved in today is once again in neuroscience. They're doing clinical trials in brain chips that can treat, whether it's depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, or once again, this idea of the brain-computer interface. Can you tap neural signals in a way that you could use a computer, you could use your iPhone, simply by thinking about things rather than touching a keyboard?
DARPA, that's what we're talking about with Sharon Weinberger. Her book is called The Imagineers of War. Where do you get the book, Sharon?
Where did I get the idea of the
book? No, I mean, where do people get it? Where do people buy the book?
Oh, they can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, in their local bookstore. Wherever you buy books, it should be available.
Super. Now, and we're going to take calls with you next hour because this is an amazing subject. What would you say has been DARPA's greatest success?
I think absolutely the internet. I think the fact that DARPA still exists today, because there have been attempts to undercut its authority, to take its budget, or even just eliminate it as an agency. The one success, the one thing that you can't argue with that truly changed the world, as the subtitle of my book says, is the internet. And the most amazing thing is this was a tiny project at DARPA. This was an agency that was working on rocket programs and nuclear test detection. You know, President Kennedy was being briefed by DARPA directors on missile defense. Nobody cared about this tiny little couple million dollar program to look at networking computers together. But look at what came out of it. And so in later years, in the 1990s and beyond, whenever somebody wanted to threaten DARPA, all they had to do was hold up the flag of the Internet. You know, we're the agency that created the Internet. That today is its greatest success. What I think we'll look at in the future is things like driverless cars, which came directly out of a DARPA million-dollar competition, as well as years of research. But still today, the Internet is the biggest success.
What would be its biggest disaster?
I think undeniably the Vietnam War. And a number of projects. There was a top secret project called Project Agile, which was an umbrella program for everything from chemical defoliation, which DARPA introduced into Vietnam and would gladly like to not take credit for today. They were involved in what was known as the Strategic Hamlet Program, which was the forced resettlement of Vietnamese peasants. They were involved in a lot of bizarre projects, ways to come up with, you know, human sniffers that could sniff the Viet Cong from the air, invisible tracers to try to track the Viet Cong. You know, there was one proposal I came across in the archives, which I don't think ever came from anything, where they talked about deploying biological weapon systems to try to protect the border between North and South Vietnam. Crazy stuff. And I think it was such a human toll. You know, when you look at Agent Orange and chemical defoliation, which came out of the DARPA work in Vietnam, the deaths on both the American side and the Vietnamese side, clearly one of DARPA's biggest failures.
Who heads up DARPA, Sharon? Who's in charge of it?
DARPA has a director, which, you know, it's usually been a scientist over the years. Its longest-serving director between 2001 and 2008 was a guy named Tony Tether. And today it's headed by a former program manager. And this is someone, it's appointed by, it's a presidential appointee, but it's not confirmed by Congress. And the director reports to the Secretary of Defense, and they have control over what is today about a $3 billion budget.
Have some presidents kept the current administrator rather than replace them, as they had the right to do?
They've sometimes let them stay over, but usually they do replace. They do replace the director, not so much for political reasons, but because, you know, administrations come in. And, you know, they want to appoint their own person. I think, for instance, Tony Tether, who was the longest-serving director, had really wanted – he was on for basically Bush 1 and Bush 2 and was hoping to stay on in the next administration. It didn't happen. The current director, Stephen Walker, was an acting director under the previous administration, but he's still technically appointed by the Trump administration. You know, but the funny thing about DARPA is it's not – you know, it's high-profile file for people who really follow science and technology. It's not usually in recent years, meaning the past 20 years. It's not something that the president keeps an eye on. So even though it's a political appointee, it's not usually something, you know, it's usually the director is not a very heavily political person. It just means that they have contacts in the current administration.
What do you think, Sharon, DARPA folks are working on now? Any breakthroughs?
Under the current director, Steve Walker, who himself directed hypersonics programs in DARPA, that is a big focus of the agency right now. Hypersonics, these are missiles, vehicles, aircraft that can travel over Mach 4 and higher, meaning over four times the speed of sound. And this is something that people are starting to hear a lot about because there's been a lot of chatter about how China and Russia are working on hypersonic weapons and that the United States is falling behind. So Stephen Walker, the current director, has been very vocal about this being an area that they're investing a lot in. They're starting some new hypersonic programs. You know, and a lot of this work is classified. So how quickly it's going forward, I think, is going to be hard to say. I don't think anybody has made the big breakthrough yet. Everyone's testing things, but these are things that are only flying for, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 minutes. I don't think anybody has cracked the code yet.
Still many secrets within DARPA?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think today, I haven't looked at its most recent budget, but if I had to take a guess, I would say about a third of its budget is still classified.
Wow.
You know, so let's take the hypersonics work. There's a lot of work that's going on in the public. Do they have classified work on hypersonics? Absolutely. Is there classified work on cybersecurity? Absolutely. I remember asking one of the office directors a few years ago about the neuroscience work. I said, would you ever classify work in neuroscience? And I expected them to say, oh, no, we never would. Instead, they said, well, yes, if we came across something in neuroscience that would give the United States a strategic advantage, we'd keep it secret. So, yeah, there's a great deal of classified work.
All right. Stay with us, Sharon. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.